Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
Yeah, it's really great to be here to explore another incredible piece of science with you.
So imagine just waking up, right?
Yeah.
You swing your legs out of bed, and suddenly the room doesn't just spin, it violently tilts.
Oh, wow. That sounds terrifying.
Yeah, you can't stand. You can't focus your eyes. And at the exact same time, there's this this loud, relentless ringing in your ears.
And a sensation like your ear is completely plugged up. Your hearing starts, you know, fading in and out.
Exactly. It's a deeply disorienting experience. Mm-hmm. And for about 1 in 2,000 people, mostly striking right in the middle of their lives in their 40s or 50s, this isn't just a bad morning.
No, not at all. It's a recurring nightmare known as Meniere disease.
Right. And we know what's happening mechanically during these attacks, but the biological trigger, that has been, well, a total ghost.
Yeah, like why does the fluid build up in the first place?
Exactly. And why does it suddenly start happening decades into someone's life?
Yeah.
What really happens when the microscopic blueprints used to build our inner ear before we were even born harbor subtle variations that don't trigger until decades later?
Today we celebrate the work of Zuzheng Shi, Ian Matheson, and their research team at the University of Pennsylvania, along with contributors from multiple global biobanks who have advanced our understanding of the genetic architecture of Meniere disease.
We're doing a deep dive into their massive study, which was published in the American Journal of Human Genetics on July 2, 2026. And honestly, the scale of this research is just staggering.
It really is.
But before we get to the scale, let's talk about the frustration. Why has Meniere disease been such a black box for so long?
Well, to understand why this is such a breakthrough, we really have to look at the clinical history. For over a century, doctors could see the physical mechanism causing the vertigo and hearing loss.
Right, they could see the effect.
Exactly. It's tied to a condition called endolymphatic hydrops. There's this fluid inside your inner ear called endolymph. In Meniere disease, that fluid builds up, increasing the pressure.
Sort of like a water balloon, slowly overfilling until the delicate sensory structures inside are severely stressed.
Spot on. So the mechanics were clear, but the root cause was fiercely debated. Was it a vascular issue restricting blood flow?
Or maybe some hidden dormant viral infection?
Right. Or was the blueprint itself flawed? You know, was it in our DNA?
And for a long time, the genetic evidence we had was pretty piecemeal. We knew that a small fraction of cases, maybe 5 to 15%, ran strongly in families.
Yeah, those familial cases were linked to very specific rare mutations in genes like OTAG and FFAM136A.
So if you inherited that specific broken gene, you had a very direct high probability of developing the disease.
But those familial cases are just a fraction of the story. The vast majority, up to 95% of Meniere disease cases, are sporadic.
They just seem to appear out of nowhere. No obvious family history at all.
Exactly. That was the massive glaring gap in our knowledge. Researchers had almost no idea how much common everyday genetic variation contributed to this disease.
So the full genetic architecture of sporadic Meniere's was completely unresolved,
yeah,
leaving millions of patients just waiting for answers.
Exactly.
So how do you solve a genetic mystery when the clues are scattered across the entire human genome, hidden among millions of sporadic cases? You go big.
You go very big. The research team performed a genome-wide association study, or GWAS meta-analysis.
Right, and to get enough statistical power, they couldn't just look at one isolated population.
No, they pulled genetic and health data from five of the world's major biobanks: the All of Us Research Program and the Million Veteran Program in the US, the UK Biobank, FinnGen in Finland, and Biobank Japan.
The numbers here are just wild. They look at 8,969 people with Meniere disease.
And compared their genomes against an astounding 1,962,542 control subjects.
We are talking about nearly 2 million people across diverse populations.
Mm-hmm.
That's unbelievable.
But that sheer massive scale is mandatory for this kind of work. When you're searching for common genetic variants that might only increase your risk by a tiny fraction, you need millions of data points.
Just to separate the true biological signals from random genetic background noise.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this methodology a bit, because the transition from a standard GW to what they did next is fascinating.
It's very clever.
Think of the initial meta-analysis like trying to locate a hidden underground facility. You combine five different satellite maps of the world. Those are the five global biobanks.
Right.
The combined satellite imagery tells you, okay, there's a lot of unusual suspicious activity in this specific city. That's your GWO signal. You found the neighborhood, but you still don't know the exact street address.
And the reason you don't know the address is due to a concept called linkage disequilibrium.
Which means what exactly?
Basically, pieces of our DNA are inherited in chunks. So in that neighborhood, the GWAS highlights, there might be hundreds of genetic variants that all light up on the test.
Not because they actually cause the disease, but just because they sit physically close to the real culprit on the DNA strand.
Yes, they get inherited right along with it.
So to find the real culprit, the researchers used a statistical fine mapping tool called SUSY. It's like sending a team on the ground to walk down the street, checking every single house until they find the exact address of the hidden facility.
Perfect analogy. It narrows down that massive suspect list to a tight, credible set of variants.
And once they had the street addresses, they used another tool called MAGEM, right?
Yes. If SUSY finds the address, MAGEMA checks the property records to see who actually owns the building. It's a gene-level association tool that maps those precise variant signals directly to specific genes.
Okay, so by combining these approaches across 2 million people, the team finally maps the genetic architecture of the disease, which brings us to the actual results.
Right, the exciting part.
What did they find when they knocked on those doors?
Well, the foundational statistic they uncovered is that the SNP heritability of Meniere disease is estimated at 7%.
Wait, before we dive into that 7%, what exactly is a SNP? For those who might not be looking at genetic charts all day.
Oh, sure. A SNP, or single nucleotide polymorphism, is basically just a single letter typo in your DNA sequence.
And we all have millions of them.
Millions, yeah. And most do absolutely nothing. But some of these tiny typos can slightly tweak how our bodies function.
Got it. Now, honestly, when I first read that the heritability from these SNPs was 7%, my initial thought was, is that it?
Right, it sounds low.
Yeah, that seems incredibly low for a disease that completely upends someone's life.
It might sound modest at first glance, but in the realm of complex traits, it's actually a highly significant polygenic contribution.
So it tells us something fundamental.
Exactly. It tells us sporadic Meniere's is not caused by a single catastrophic broken gene. Instead, it has a polygenic architecture.
Meaning, it's the cumulative weight of many, many small genetic nudges across the genome that slowly tips a person over the threshold.
Yes, death by 1,000 microscopic paper cuts.
Ouch. And out of all those tiny nudges, the fine mapping team pinpointed 5 independent genome-wide significant variants.
Yes, and to keep us from drowning in an alphanumeric soup of gene names, we can group these variants into 2 distinct biological themes.
Good idea. The first group we can call the architect genes, right? Specifically variants near the genes EYA4 and EYA1.
Correct. Those 2 genes are absolutely crucial for inner ear development. They encode proteins that act as transcriptional regulators and phosphatases.
So in plain English, they are the site managers on a cellular construction site.
Exactly. They tell other genes when to turn on and off, directing the intricate construction of the inner ear while we are still embryos.
Okay, but this raises a huge red flag for me. If these architect genes are responsible for building the ear when we are fetuses, why does Meniere disease usually not show up until someone is in their 40s or 50s?
That is the critical paradox the paper resolves brilliantly.
Why isn't the problem obvious from day one?
Because the genetic risk variants they found at EYA4 and EYA1 do not break the genes. They aren't loss-of-function mutations that cause a baby to be born deaf or with a visibly malformed ear.
Oh, I see. So what are they doing?
Well, these common variants are located in non-coding regions of the DNA. They alter the expression of the genes. They act more like a regulatory dimmer switch than a hard-on-off switch.
Ah, so it's like building a house with a slightly altered architectural blueprint.
Hmm.
The builders use a slightly thinner grade of timber for the roof supports.
Yes.
When the house is built, it looks perfectly fine. You can move in, your furniture fits, everything works.
But after decades of facing the elements, snowstorms, heavy rain, wind, the stress accumulates.
And eventually, in year 40 or 50, the roof starts to leak.
That is a perfect analogy for homeostatic stress. The subtle regulatory changes in those architect genes likely cause microscopic structural or functional vulnerabilities in the sensory tissues of the ear.
So the ear functions normally for decades, but it has a reduced baseline capacity to handle the daily constant stress of regulating fluid pressure.
Precisely. Over time, that wear and tear overcomes the ear's compensatory mechanisms, leading to the sudden, late-onset attacks of vertigo and fluid buildup.
Wow. That fundamentally changes how you think about an adult onset disease. It's really a slow motion consequence of a fetal blueprint.
And this developmental theme is heavily reinforced by the second biological pathway they uncovered.
Right, so if the first group were the architect genes, the second group involves the chemical gradient genes.
Yes, specifically surrounding a signaling molecule called retinoic acid.
Let's talk about that. The fine mapping pointed to a gene called CYP26A1, along with another suggestive locus called ALDH1A2.
Retinoic acid is a derivative of vitamin A, and it's one of the most important signaling molecules in human biology. During embryogenesis, retinoic acid acts as a morphogen.
Meaning it forms a concentration gradient, high amounts in one area, low amounts in another.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Which tells developing stem cells exactly where they are in the body and what they need to become.
It provides the spatial GPS for building the brain, the eyes, and importantly, the inner ear. So I'm guessing those two genes manage that GPS signal.
You've got it. The gene ALDH1A2 is responsible for synthesizing retinoic acid, actively making more of it. On the flip side, CYP26A1 is responsible for degrading it, clearing it away.
I picture retinoic acid like the heat from a campfire. Cells close to the fire where the concentration is high know to become one specific part of the inner ear. Cells out in the cold where the concentration is low become a different part.
That's a great way to look at it.
So ALDH1A2 is throwing logs on the fire, while CYP26A1 acts like a fan blowing the heat away to create that perfect temperature gradient.
And that gradient has to be flawless. In animal models, if you disrupt these specific enzymes, the vestibular sensory epithelium, the exact part of the ear that detects balance and motion, does not form correctly.
So once again, we're looking at genes that are fundamental to early embryonic ear construction. But I have the same question here. Does retinoic acid just build the ear? And once we are born, those genes shut off?
Actually, that's the kicker. They don't shut off. Retinoic acid isn't just a builder. It's also the maintenance crew.
Oh, really? How does this connect to the fluid buildup in a 50-year-old?
It plays an ongoing role in maintaining tissue homeostasis and fluid dynamics in the adult body. And to prove this, the researchers did something really clever. They ran a phenom-wide association study, or PHEWAS, along with a genetic correlation analysis.
Meaning they took these specific genetic variants and checked them against a massive catalog of other diseases to see where else they show up.
Right. They asked what other conditions share this exact same genetic architecture. And the results were incredibly eye-opening.
What did they find?
They found that Meniere disease genetically correlates with conditions that on the surface seem completely unrelated, like migraines and even sleep apnea. But the one that really stands out is glaucoma.
Oh, wow. Glaucoma is fascinating here because it is fundamentally a fluid tension disorder of the eye.
Exactly.
Fluid builds up, creating pressure that damages the optic nerve.
Yeah.
Meniere disease is a fluid tension disorder of the ear.
The fact that genetic variations near retinoic acid signaling genes are implicated in both conditions suggests a shared biological vulnerability.
So retinoic acid pathways might be a universal mechanism for regulating fluid pressure in sensory organs across the whole body. That is amazing.
If we step back and look at the whole picture, this study isn't just dropping a few new genes into a database. It is shifting the entire paradigm of how we view Meniere disease.
It truly bridges the gap between developmental biology and adult physiological dysfunction.
Yes. For decades, researchers were looking for a localized mechanical failure in the adult ear. This paper proves that the mechanical failure is just the final domino. The first domino was set in place before the patient was even born.
It also elegantly reconciles the genetics, doesn't it? It proves that the rare coding variants found in familial cases and the common regulatory variations found in sporadic cases aren't two different diseases.
No, they aren't. They're just complementary layers of the exact same risk architecture.
It's an incredible piece of synthesis. But as with all groundbreaking science, we have to look at the boundaries of what the data can actually tell us.
Right. The researchers were very transparent about the limitations of their study, particularly regarding how they defined who actually had the disease in these massive biobanks.
Because they were pulling from electronic health records, or EHRs, they had to rely on diagnostic billing codes to identify the cases.
And Meniere disease is notoriously difficult to diagnose in a standard clinical setting. Its symptoms, the vertigo, the hearing loss, the tinnitus overlap heavily with other vestibular disorders.
Like vestibular migraine or benign paroxysmal positional vertigo.
Exactly. This clinical misclassification introduces noise into the data. If a doctor miscoded a patient's chart, that patient ends up in the wrong column in the biobank data.
And in statistics, This kind of noise tends to bias the effect size estimates towards zero.
Yes.
Visualize that bias towards zero for a second. Imagine trying to listen to a faint radio station. That's the true 7% genetic signal.
Okay.
Clinical misclassification is like adding static to the dial. The more people who are misdiagnosed and put into the wrong data column, the louder the static gets, drowning out the music.
That captures the limitation perfectly. The actual genetic connection is probably much stronger than 7%. We just can't hear it clearly through the messy hospital coding.
Makes total sense.
Additionally, for most of the biobanks, the researchers only had access to summary statistics rather than individual level genetic data, which restricted their ability to perform uniform quality control across all 2 million participants.
But even through that static, the signals at the architect genes and the retinoic acid genes rang through clearly across multiple ancestries.
They absolutely did.
So now that we have the addresses of these genetic variants, what are the next steps? How do we prove exactly what they're doing in a living ear?
The immediate next step is functional validation. Researchers can now use human inner ear organoids, which are essentially miniature, lab-grown, 3D versions of the human inner ear and animal models to test these specific genes.
That is practically science fiction. Growing a mini inner ear in a lab to test a 50-year-old's vertigo risk.
It really is wild. By taking these organoids and artificially tweaking the regulatory pathways of the architect genes or altering the retinoic acid gradients, they can watch in real time how it affects fluid balance and sensory cell health.
And ultimately, this paves the way for predictive polygenic risk models.
Exactly. If we know the combination of subtle genetic nudges that lead to meniere's, we might eventually be able to identify patients who are at high risk long before the fluid ever starts to build up.
Which introduces a completely new, thought-provoking idea to consider.
Oh, yeah.
If a classic adult-onset condition like Meniere disease is actually rooted in subtle embryonic developmental tweaks, it forces us to question other conditions.
Could other common wear and tear aging conditions, like age-related hearing loss, chronic balance issues, or even certain types of joint degradation, secretly be developmental disorders in disguise?
Are they just tiny structural vulnerabilities waiting on the clock to run out?
That's awesome.
Wild thought. We always assume aging is just the machine breaking down from use over time.
But maybe the machine was designed with a specific microscopic expiration date embedded in certain tissues from the very beginning.
It's a fascinating perspective. To summarize the central insight of this massive effort, Meniere disease is driven by polygenic risk factors, specifically subtle regulatory variations in genes that control the development of the inner ear and the processing of retinoic acid.
This frames the disorder not just as a mechanical failure of the adult ear, but as a lifelong trajectory set in motion before birth.
What does this mean for our ability to eventually predict and prevent adult onset sensory disorders by looking at our earliest developmental blueprints? This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
In the hallway, everything sways. A quiet storm in the inner maze. I chase the reason through the noise, trying to name these phantom waves. On bright screens, the patterns align. Lit switches on the boundary line. Not fate, not flaw, just threads that bend where sense begins and spins again. Trouble sings. of a set time and right. 7% and still it matters. Small waves make glass from shatter. Better go tonight, a sleepless night. It's all cross-linked, an electric light. Hold steady, there's a map in view.